Hello and welcome to the Witness podcast from the BBC World Service with me, Alex Last. And today, using recordings from the BBC's amazing archive, we go back to a defining moment of the 20th century when the Russian Tsar abdicated in the First Russian Revolution of 1917.
The Russian Revolution came as a thief in the night. We felt it was coming, but had no idea when. Suddenly it was there.
In March 1917, violence and protest erupted in the Russian capital, Petrograd, now called St. Petersburg. After centuries of autocratic rule, Russia was in the grip of revolution, as remembered by British and exiled Russian eyewitnesses who spoke to the BBC.
People went singing songs, protected by the soldiers, and I remember passing our window and a lot of the shouts were, "This is the first bloodless revolution. We're having no bloodshed. But by the next day, a lot of the policemen were being murdered and burned to death, and one heard their screams and shouts.
It was a realization of all desire, all dreams, all fight for the liberation, for the reconstruction of Russia as a free democracy based on all human rights and social justice.
The events of March 1917 had been brewing for years. Nicholas II became Tsar in 1894. He was part of the Romanov dynasty who'd ruled Russia for 300 years.
He was a short man. He always wore a simple Russian uniform. And in face, he looked exactly like King George V. They were first cousins, and the family resemblance was extremely strong. There was a brilliant season, a great many balls and parties, and it was said, I don't know with what truth, that a train used to arrive every day with flowers from Nice for the decoration of the rooms.
But the reality of life for most Russians was far removed from the lavish life at court.
The difference between the rich and the poor was like night and day. And the poverty that I saw among the working classes just outside St. Petersburg at the mills and works was really pathetic.
And Nicholas II was not a stranger to crisis. In 1905, troops had opened fire on a huge crowd of workers who'd come to the Tsar's palace in a peaceful demonstration. In the aftermath, as protests escalated, the Tsar was forced to agree to reforms, including the creation of a kind of parliament, the Duma. But the Tsar soon deprived it of any authority and resisted calls for change. But then in 1914 came the First World War. Russia's corrupt, ineffective administration could not cope. Its army, poorly equipped, badly led, suffered terribly. Facing the armies of Germany, Austro-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, Russia lost millions of men. The Tsar, who'd taken command of the armies himself, could not escape blame.
Despite the fact that I knew him personally and I felt a warm feeling of affection for him as man to man, I did not consider him a strong and powerful enough man to head a large country like Russia, and especially during the war.
Among many Russians, there was suspicion of the Tsar's German-born wife, the Tsarina Alexandra, and anger at the growing power of the dissolute royal favourite, the mystic Rasputin, who'd gained huge power at court through his supposed ability to heal the sickly heir to the throne. And as the country was battered and drained by war, at home, Russia was struggling with shortages and inflation.
The atmosphere was a very depressing one, and yet a very exciting one. One realized that the army was doing badly, that there was defeat on all fronts. Large convoys of wounded people were coming in, and the atmosphere amongst the soldiers was very depressing and depressed. They were talking of defeat, talking of treason, talking of the fact they had no guns, no ammunition, largely due, as the soldiers said, to the fact that the high command was corrupt, that the Tsar was obviously in league with the enemies, and the Tsarina, who was a German, was suspected of complicity.
Well, we had very little to eat by 1917. We had to send our servant out to stand in the queue. She took up her position at 5 o'clock in the morning, and that's no joke in the winter in St. Petersburg. The doors of the shop would open at, say, 8, and very often close immediately with a notice, no bread today.
And in March 1917, in St. Petersburg, now called Petrograd, huge workers' protests began again.
There were riots and disorder in the streets, and I think this is the best description of a revolution. People were smashing up shops, looting bread shops, tram cars were being overturned, barricades were being built, and obviously something was imminent.
Out of the bread riot grew one strike, and then another, until the people began to feel their power.
There was a great deal of fighting. Red flags were now to be seen everywhere. The soldiers tied strips of red to their bayonets. The civilians wore red armlets, or streamers, from their buttonholes. The police were armed with machine guns, which had been placed several weeks before on roofs and in the attics of houses commanding the principal thoroughfares. Machine guns had also been placed on the Duma building and even on the churches.
Troops sent to disperse the crowds fraternized with the people. Some policemen who remained loyal fired on the crowd and so ensured their own death. On March 11, the crowds were masters of the capital and were enjoying themselves by arresting frightened ministers and releasing prisoners.
The Tsar's authority was in tatters. Criticised on all sides, he felt he could not go on. And finally, he took the momentous decision to abdicate.
We, Nicholas, by the grace of God, Emperor of all the Russias, King of Poland, Archduke of Finland, to all our faithful subjects, in agreement with the Imperial Duma, we have thought good to abdicate the crown and lay down the supreme power.
Above all, it was a hopeful revolution. Everyone not only wanted a change, but believed a new era was dawning, an era in which all would be free.
But some royalists felt the Tsar's abdication was an act of betrayal.
Hearing that news, every single man, officers and soldiers, wept. An old grey-haired colonel said in tears, "The Tsar has abandoned us."
As a replacement to autocratic Tsarist rule, the Duma set up a provisional government in Petrograd, would eventually be led by a socialist deputy, Alexander Kerensky. But in reality, it had to share power with the city's newly formed and more radical Council of Workers and Soldiers, called the Petrograd Soviet. The provisional government pledged to continue the war, Russia's huge problems remained, and the revolution began to swing dramatically to the left.
Food supplies were failing, transport had broken down, the army was melting away. What I now saw in Russia was an attempt to establish a central government, which was not autocratic but democratic, in our sense of the word. It failed not because heroic efforts were not made by Kerensky and his colleagues. Chaos supervened, and to end it, autocracy came again, but this time under the aegis of a group of socialist intellectuals, most of whom had been living in exile, who were called Bolshevik.
So while many moderates hoped Russia would become a liberal democracy, Bolshevik revolutionaries like Lenin and Trotsky had other plans. The Russian Revolution was far from over. That's it for this edition of the Witness podcast with me, Alex Last. There are lots more Witness podcasts to listen to, so do have a browse around. And do look out for the next episode of the Witness podcast, which is by Dina Newman, about the extraordinary Russian photographer who documented the last years of Tsarist rule in colour. But that's it from me. Until the next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.